May I introduce myself? I am Max Freedom Long, a founding fellow of the Huna Fellowship, also a teaching fellow. I wish tonight to introduce to you a subject which is very dear to my heart, and the research work on which has occupied me for perhaps 45 years. I wish to tell you about the oldest and best kept secret in the world. It is a secret which it combines a knowledge of psychology with a knowledge of religion and with a knowledge of the way to put the secret to work. It is perhaps the finest and best system of psychology that the world has ever known, and in modern times we have not quite caught up with it. You might say that we have learned about two-thirds of it ourselves in modern times, but there is still a third which the modern psychologist does not know. As to the religious aspect, it is the simplest, the most complete, and the finest system of religion which was ever developed, so far as I have been able to learn. This system was without a name. It was secret. It was handed down from parent to child through centuries and centuries of time. The knowledge of it spread by initiation through several parts of the world. We'll go into that a little bit later. In my own search to find the secret, may I say this? I'm telling the story a little bit backward because it was years and years before I was able to say that the first traces of it were picked up in the ancient Assyrian and Babylonian country, in the Chaldean. Then, from there, the next set of traces were found in Egypt, and they were very much better and very much stronger. The Egyptians had names for the different parts of the psychology, which, by the way, has 10 parts. After the discovery of it in Egypt, it is traced on into the Holy Land. And there the Jews were apparently initiated some of the time. That is, they had certain ones. Whether they were fully initiated as a rule or not, we do not know. But we find traces of the ancient system coded into Genesis and very clearly coded into Isaiah. So there were Jews in the old days, prophets, who were initiates. As we go along, we find that the initiation seemed to have been more general and more complete in a certain section. The writers of the four Gospels were all initiates, and the tradition is that they thought perhaps the old secret lore would be lost, so they coded it in a special code language and wrote it into the four Gospels. It was not written down and described in any other place. That is the only source from which the code can be selected, picked out, and examined. The New Testament is an invaluable document to us, but it was very late in my long research before I discovered that the writers of the Gospels had coded it, and when the code was broken and the Gospels were made to give their secret or their part of the great secret, then, and only then, did we find out what it was that Jesus taught in secret to the disciples. Of course, as you may know, there has been the tradition for centuries that there was a hidden meaning in the Bible and in the New Testament. Many people have thought that they have found this hidden and coded meaning and have written books to say, this means a certain thing. When they use this word, they mean another thing. And their proof was, because I say so. In our work, the proof is entirely different and of quite a more valid nature. The thing that Jesus taught in secret was, we might say, just as a beginning, a second salvation. The first salvation is the external of the Gospels as they have come down to us, mixed with much dogma, thanks to Paul's part in the work. After the spread of Huna through the Gospel country, say about 2,000 years ago, it might have been known by the people who wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls. We're not too certain of that, but we find that they were the ones who had very largely presented all of the ideas which went into the externals of the Gospels. So it is a fairly safe guess that the writers of the Gospels and the writers of the Dead Sea Scrolls were all Huna initiates. Now I've used the word Huna. I must stop to explain that. This system, so far as I could find out, had no name. It must have had a name that was used by the initiates and by the parents teaching their children to understand and to use the ancient system. But I found no name for it, except it was always referred to as the secret. And looking into the language which was used for the code, that was a Polynesian tongue, I selected the word Huna, which means secret. So we call the system the secret, or Huna. That's spelled H-U-N-A. Sometimes it's mistakenly pronounced Huna, but it's not a long U. It's like a double O. It is Huna. Moving on from the Holy Land, about 2,000 years ago, the keepers of the secret, that is the name that we have for the priests, they called them kahuns in the Jewish, any name for a priest in the Jewish is kahun. But kahuna was the Polynesian version of it and is in one of the dialects of Polynesian. But to get back to my story, leaving the Gospel country and Egypt, sometime about 2,000 years ago, the initiate people, they might have been a separate race, probably were. They spoke a common language which had been taken by the initiates and used to make the code in which to write the secret into the Gospels and into parts of the Old Testament. The tradition is that they feared that the secret, which they valued very greatly, would be lost, or that it would be so contaminated that it would be practically lost. So, using their psychic powers, they looked around the world for a place to which they might move and in which they might keep the secret alive. The place that they discovered was the empty Pacific. At that time, there were practically nobody and no people living on the islands of the Pacific. There may have been the Abos in Australia. They didn't move into that part, but they moved into New Guinea. They moved on to Tahiti, to Samoa, to various parts. And as they were a maritime people, apparently in Egypt, which may have been the staging place for the departure, they went by double canoes, large double canoes with little houses built for cabins and for protection from the weather between the big double canoes. They sailed and they paddled. Apparently they split, and out of 11 different branches, which was represented by 11 dialects of what later has become the Polynesian general tongue, some of them went down along from the Red Sea and sailed down along the coast of Africa. When they got down as far as the great island of Madagascar, they seem to have settled there for a time, perhaps to rest and to get ready for another voyage, and perhaps they never came away. At any rate, in Madagascar, half of the island today, 2,000 years later, has the Polynesian type of person living there. They are a light brown people, Caucasians. They speak a language which is not related to other languages very closely. It's a language that has puzzled the students for quite a while to try to find where it originated and how it was made up. The migration in the other direction split and went up on the side by Arabia and into India. And in India, we find traces of the ideas, but not so much of the language. In Madagascar, the language tells the story. In India, the story is told by the ideas that were left behind. The kahunas, or the native keeper of the secret, that is what the word translates. A ka is of, and huna is the secret. These were the priests of the secret, or the keepers of it. They must have made friends with the religious men of the Hindus about 2,000 years ago. At that time, yoga was getting started, and the devotees and the teachers of yoga apparently were initiated. How many of them were initiated completely, we do not know. But what they did know, they tried to keep for a long time, and gradually it became contaminated. Part of the work of the white magic, which is used by the practitioners of Huna, involved a use of breathing exercises. And in yoga, the breathing exercises were used. The use of them apparently was known for a time and then lost. And when they lost the secret of the breathing exercises, they began to experiment. So we have several different kinds of yoga. In the tantric yoga, we find the posturing and the meditations and concentrations with many, many symbols, and the concentration on the different nerve centers up and down the spine, the chakras or coins. The idea was lost and mixed and muddled until finally, at the present time in yoga, you have find almost nothing left of the practical application, but many traces of the original Huna idea. From India, the people moved on, and possibly up through Sumatra and Java and the Straits, and at least a part of the tribe from Madagascar must have joined them there, because in the island, scattered here and there, we have 11 different dialects of the Polynesian tongue. Madagascar furnishes one dialect. The other 10 are better represented. But there are three standard dialects, two in New Zealand and one in Hawaii, one in Tahiti, and another closely related to the others in Samoa. The migration from the Holy Land was one which we date as about 2,000 years ago. It was before the writing of the four Gospels, or at least before the four Gospels became generally public. They might have been secret for a time in their written form. And we know this because the missionaries coming into Hawaii and making the contact with the Polynesian keepers of the secret were surprised to find that they knew all about Genesis. They knew the story of the flood. Those were stories that had come from Chaldea and Babylonia when the Jews were in captivity there. The Egyptians had less marked traditions and legends of that kind, so we know that these people had some connection in Hawaii, had some connection with the early Jews in the Holy Land, and possibly the Jews while they were in exile in Egypt. The kahunas in Hawaii preserved the language with the greatest care because in the language lay the code which described this secret system. If the language had been changed, then the code could not have been broken at any time by anyone. It would have been too badly tangled and muddled. So, in order to keep the language pure, the kahunas, who had two kinds of worship, a temple worship with rituals and things of that type, and then a more private worship, which was given largely to healing. But in the temple worship, they had young kahunas who were trained to recite long chants, usually covering the history of the people and the genealogy of the chiefs and the higher brackets of the social system. In these genealogies and the legendary history, any young priest who changed a word or a syllable or a pronunciation was promptly disgraced. He was thrown out and had to come next year to take his examination and do it all over again. The result of that was that the language for 2,000 years suffered almost no change at all in Hawaii. It suffered a little more change in New Zealand and slightly more change in Tahiti. But it is the Hawaiian which is the purest and which was used when it came time to break the code. The breaking of the code is a story all by itself, but before I go into that, I want to say that the traces of Huna that were left in India with the yogins were so well preserved that when Buddha came along and established Buddhism as a reform of the Brahmanism of his day and added much dogma as well as cleaning out a lot of old things from the older religions, of which there were many. In Buddhism, there was an esoteric section, which can only be understood once that you know the Huna system, and the code does not apply to the language in which Buddhism was written down. That's the Pali, and the teachings of Buddha were written down 700 years after his death, in a language which he never used, so it's no good for the code. But whenever you run into the ideas which are common to Huna, then you realize that there must have been a knowledge on the part of Buddha and his followers of Huna. The great aim of attaining to nirvana takes on an entirely different meaning when you understand Huna and the code. Ordinarily, we say that nirvana means a blowing out, like a blowing out of a candle, an extinction of life, so that you'd blend back into this source of all life and cease to exist. From the Huna angle, it is something quite different, and we will get around to that one of these days. A little bit later, in the 7th century, we pick up traces of Huna, which had traveled overland with the Nestorian missionaries. They were Christian missionaries who traveled far and wide, and they came into China and taught a variety of Christianity which also contained the initiatory code work, so that there in an old work called The Secret of the Golden Flower, which we have in translation, for anyone who knows Huna, you can go right into it, and the code itself is not in the language translated into English, but in the ideas. They had many ideas. For instance, they used words as symbols. The prayer was known because it had a seed in it, and the seed was the idea of the prayer that was sent to the superconscious mind to materialize, so that that seed would grow. And their symbol was to send the seed to the light. The light symbolized the superconscious self. And then you sent vital force daily as water, which was the symbol of the vital force, to water the seed so that it would grow in God's garden, you might say. In Polynesia, the system did fairly well during the 2,000 years, but the temple worship became a little bit degraded. There were political aspects that crept in. There were wars back and forth, so that by the time the missionaries came into the islands, the common people were being imposed upon by the priests of the temple worship type. And there was one priest in the group of, there were 52 kinds of priests. Everyone who had a skill was a kahuna of sorts. The shipbuilder was a kahuna. He worked with chants. But the real kahunas that knew the inner work were the healers. They were able to look into the future. They were able to do slow healing and very often instant healing. They could heal broken bones often in just a moment. And they had a regular ritual, which is something of great value, which we will get into when the time is ripe for that. The missionaries arrived. The kahunas were very much impressed with their claim that Jesus did miracles a very fine group of miracles. And so they said to themselves, the Christians must know all about Huna. So they brought all of their sick and blind and syphilitic and people with venereal diseases that the kahunas had not been able to heal to the first doctor that arrived with the missionaries, and were all ready to be healed, and the doctor could do nothing. So they slowly realized that the Christians, while they had the outer semblance of some of Huna, had lost the secret. They didn't know how to use the things that they were supposed to know. Little by little, the kahunas, when the missionaries became politically strong by their influence with the chiefs, were outlawed. So that after a number of years of the missionary dominance in all of the various islands of the Pacific, the kahunas were driven to cover, the bad ones and the good ones together. The younger people, the daughters and the sons, who normally would have taken the initiation over a period of years and would practice and would have learned to do all of the healing, they would have learned all the lore, all through the coded language that would be used between them. The younger people did not take the training. There was no use for it because they were outlawed. And gradually the older kahunas began to die out. The lore began to die with them, and one of the greatest tragedies of the present century, or I should say the last century, was that Huna, finally, after all the centuries, became lost. No one knew it. A few of the very old kahunas, as they died, had known part of it, but they didn't know it all, and they hadn't handed it down. In Hawaii, as a young man, I became acquainted with the curator of the Bishop Museum, Dr. William Tufts Brigham, who was a great student and had been for 40 years studying the Hawaiians, studying things that had to do with the Polynesian archipelago. And he took me under his wing and agreed to teach me what he knew about the native kahuna lore. He had done fire walking with them over red-hot lava, which had barely cooled enough to bear the weight of a man or a big stone. They tested it by throwing stones out first. It was a lava overflow from a volcano. And he had received no burns at all. He had burned his great mountain boots off of his feet and his two pairs of socks. But the three kahunas that were working right along with him and showing him the art, they thought that he was a kahuna. He pretended to be, and so they were teaching him this special thing. They were volcano kahunas who knew fire walking. They didn't know very much else, I imagine. So he became curious, and he set about trying to find out how they did that. He tried all of the theories that had been given. They didn't have any asbestos on their feet. They had no preparation of any kind physically. Then he tried to find out what they did mentally. What was it that they did with their minds that made it possible to walk barefooted over red-hot lava and to protect him? And he learned the chants, but all that he could find out from that was that they prayed to a superior being, in that case the goddess of the sky, which means very little, and that the response, after they had gone through a certain ritual, was always to be depended upon. Firewalking was also known, and is today, in other parts of the world. It was not originated by the Polynesians. I doubt that they had it very much earlier than the 4th century. But that was what had brought Dr. Brigham into the study, was his own personal experience. He also had had some nasty experience with the death prayer kahuna. He was one of the 52 varieties. He was a spiritualist, and he used spirits to kill people. He was the police force in the early days, part of it, and people who were beyond the reach of ordinary law, the rich and the powerful who imposed on the poor and the helpless, they could go to this kahuna ana ana, that was the Polynesian name for him, and lay their case before him. And if he agreed that they had been injured unjustly, had been hurt, they had violated the law of no hurt, which had been that of the kahunas for centuries and centuries, then they would send their trained spirits to kill the person who had done the dirty work. If the person found himself dying gradually in the course of 3 days and realized that he was being punished by a kahuna, he had one chance to come out safely, and that was to go to that kahuna or to another and lay his case before them and agree to make amends. If he agreed to make amends and come clean, then the spirits would be called off and he would live. Down in Hawaii, even Dr. Brigham's time, there were a few of the kahunas that were driven to cover, but they still worked. And now and then, they were bad enough to use their killing art for their own prejudicial purposes. One of them disliked Dr. Brigham for some reason or other, and thought that he was nosing around too much in the circles of the secret. So he attempted to pray to death one of the boys, Hawaiian boys, who was out with him on a botanical collecting expedition. And Dr. Brigham had quite a struggle to fight off the spirits with hypnosis and get them to release the boy. That is a story that I have told in detail in one of my first earlier books on the subject. The story of the finding of the Huna traces back in Egypt is not without its amusing side. I found in Hawaii that the subconscious mind, yes, they knew the subconscious, the conscious, and the superconscious. That is part of their psychology. The Hawaiian's name for the subconscious was grasshopper, Unihipili. And that also was the name for it in Egypt. So when I ran into the same strange name for the subconscious clear back in the days of Egypt when they used glyphs, the little pictures that they used to write, they pictured the grasshopper. And that was the subconscious soul of man. So when I ran into the same strange name for the subconscious clear back in the days of Egypt when they used glyphs, the little pictures that they used to write, they pictured the grasshopper. And that was the subconscious soul of man. The word that they used was not Unihipili, it was Ba. They had the Ba and the Ka. But the Hawaiians had quite a different approach to that. We will go into that on the lecture as we proceed. The mention of the grasshopper was just simply a little example of the code that I'm talking about. I want now to tell you about the breaking of the code. That code which had kept the secret inviolate for over perhaps 5,000 or 6,000 years was finally broken after a long period of study and research. Dr. Brigham knew nothing about the inner workings of Huna. He suspected a great deal, but he had never been able to get any of the kahunas to tell him just what they believed or how they went about doing their miracle healing, their slow healing, their instant healing, or their firewalking. He could see the externals. He knew what they did externally. They had a form of cleansing in which it was like a baptism with water sprinkled, and they cleansed the patients and got them rid of their sins. And then when they were ready and had made amends for the hurts that they had done to others, for the hurts they had done to others. They made amends, and then they were ready to have the healing done for them through the kahunas by the superconscious part of mind, which we in psychology have not caught up with yet, but which is now postulated in religion more and more. People are turning in religion to the idea of the superconscious. However, in the Hawaiian, the superconscious is so much more easily understood and is so much clearer. In the matter of this code and the language of the code was Polynesian. The Hawaiian is the best preserved example of the 11 dialects of the Polynesian. And if you wish to understand the code, for instance, in the four Gospels, you take the four Gospels and translate them back into the Hawaiian. Fortunately, this was done by the missionaries. They gave us beautiful translations of the entire Bible in a fairly good Hawaiian. They had one difficulty when it came to the fact that the original kahunas had used the words for the subconscious, the conscious and the superconscious. The missionaries in those days had no knowledge of the subconscious. Psychology as a science had not yet guessed that there was such a thing as a subconscious. And so they looked all through the Hawaiian language as they knew it and talked with the kahunas. And finally they used the word for the conscious mind for the subconscious. For the superconscious mind, they had a very good word. It was the symbol word for the superconscious of Father. And the Father was quite familiar to them, so they could use the word for Father. The words which made up the code, when I tried to understand what the Hawaiians had used in the way of a language to tell the sons and daughters about the secret, that gave me the clue. In the language, they have little roots. It's a simple language, not agglutinated, and it is made up of small root words. For instance, the word for the subconscious, the grasshopper, is pronounced in two ways, unihipili and unatihili. Those words are made up of little overlapping roots, most of them, of two letters apiece. There's one three-letter root in there. They use them overlapping, so you take the first sound from one little code root word and add it to the next. Anyway, there are seven little roots in the word unihipili for the subconscious, the grasshopper. And those describe the characteristic of the subconscious mind beautifully. They show that it is stubborn, that it is very secretive, that it is very closely attached to the conscious mind, that it will do things when it wishes to do it, and when it does not wish to do them, it will refuse to do them. We find that also one of the roots means sticky, and as we go on later on, you will find that that word sticky has to do with the mechanism of telepathy. It's a rather an odd thing, but there was the root. Now the root words in the word for the conscious mind, when I ran into that, that word was uhani. The little words that start with U had originally an A to them, but in shortening the language, they elided the A, so that in unihipili, it would be au, A-U for a start, and that means a self, I. The same thing is in uhani, for the conscious mind. That also was an I, a self, and it was the self who hanied. Hani means to talk, and the only description that the roots gave of the conscious mind were the two roots that said it is the talker. This is interesting because we know that the human animal is the only one in the entire animal kingdom which is able to talk and still understand what it says. The parrot talks, and the various things like the minor bird, they talk, but they have no idea what they're talking about. They are talking through their hats all the time, so to speak. The code word for the superconscious is au makua. In that, the A has not been elided or lost. It is the self. It is not very well handled as a code word. Makua means a parental, a pair of spirits. And it is the parental spirit. The mother angle of it was taken for granted. You can't have a father without a mother. And in Christianity, that was one of the stumbling blocks. In the outer part of the New Testament, we pray to the Father, but the mother was left out. When you get back into the code and understand what the original father was, you realize that it was a united male-female spirit, a pair of spirits united who had come up through the school of life, had once been subconscious spirits, had once been conscious mind spirits, and had finally evolved to the high state of being the superconscious or parental older spirits. The roots mean very old. The translation for this word, Aumakua, given by one of the students of the Hawaiian lore, was utterly trustworthy parental spirit. In other words, it had learned not to sin, not to hurt anyone, and in its high state, it was utterly trustworthy. It could be trusted in every possible way, trusted to love the low and the middle self with whom it was connected and is connected in all of us, and to do everything possible, everything that we will allow it by our actions to do, to help us, to guide us, to keep us on the straight and narrow path. Leaving the actual translation of the little root words, we come to the second part of the code, and this was a more difficult thing to break because it was simply the use of various words as symbols of something. Water, for instance, was the symbol of the vital force of the human being. They used the word for seed. They used the word for light. Light was the symbol of the high self. They used the word path to denote the connection between the middle and low selves and the high self, or superconscious. With the breaking of the code, I gradually came to know what those word symbols had to do with the entire philosophy as it was hidden and coded. But it took a period of almost 40 years to get really well versed in the code and to be able to approach the Gospels and to be able to find out exactly what had been coded into them, the things that you might say again had been taught in secret by Jesus. I started my approach to the breaking of the code with the low self as the grasshopper, and I worked up, found the coded meanings in the system for the conscious mind, the talker, and then for the father-mother parental spirit. There's a rather interesting story connected with the going up and the going down in investigation. After I had partially uncovered the ancient Huna system, I wrote a book about it. It was called Recovering the Ancient Magic and was published in England. It had short life because the edition was bombed out by the Blitz in World War I. But the book got circulating before that time, and an Englishman read it who had had a strange experience, and he wrote to me and told me about it. His name was Reginald Stewart, and as a young man he had heard down in the Berber country in North Africa of a tribe of people who had a natural knowledge of magic. They thought it was natural, but it really was not. He went back into the back country. He found that this was a shepherd tribe, and they had a woman queen. She was the queen Kwahini. That is what they called her, the Kwahini. Vahini means woman in the Polynesian dialect, so she was really a woman kahuna, and she knew the ancient lore, but she couldn't tell him about it because he was not a blood relative. The result of his manipulation was that he got himself made a blood son, and she had a daughter of 17 who was just about to begin to take her training from the mother as a kahuna in her turn. So the old lady agreed to teach this young Englishman and the daughter at the same time. She started in demonstrating her powers to show them what she could do, and she did some rather amazing things. Then she started to teach them the philosophy, and she started in with the parental spirit, the high self, the superconscious, told them all about that. And then she said, the conscious mind self, that is you, so we don't need to say too much about it, except that it has certain powers. The lessons got that far, but never got down to the subconscious, never got to the other parts that I had run into that were very valuable and indispensable. But the woman who was teaching them, there was a little war between two other tribes, and they were fighting up and down in the valley, and Stuart and his teacher and the daughter went to look down to watch the battle, and a stray bullet struck the teacher over the heart and killed her. So his chance to learn Huna from this Berber woman was lost. She had told them before her death that the tradition of their tribe was that they had stayed with other tribes, maybe 12 in number, in Egypt to help build the pyramids because they could levitate the rocks to make them move up and lift them by magic. While the others had gone into a far place, she didn't know just where, to preserve the secret lore. When the others had gone, her tribe, for some reason or other, did not move into the Pacific, but they perhaps the Red Sea was closed to them by that time. So they were forced to leave. They went up into the mountain countries of North Africa and mixed with what are perhaps the Berber people of today. They might have been the ancestors of the Berbers, I don't know. But in any event, they had preserved this knowledge almost as long as it had been preserved in Hawaii, but not in the code. He had been taught by this woman in French. She spoke French, and he spoke French as well as English. And with a little translation in between, he had been able to get a very good idea of the upper brackets of Huna. I was a little weak on the upper brackets in my research, so I was very glad to have him give me all the information that he had about the high self, the superconscious, the Almakua. In his notes, which he transcribed kept for years, they were old and yellowed by the time he read my book, he found that some of the words that she had used and which he had been having difficult times to translate were almost pure Tahitian. That seemed to be the nearest to the dialect, nearer than the Hawaiian. The old story of the lost tribes of Israel may be connected in there in some way. I don't remember how many lost tribes there were of Israel, but there were 11 of the Polynesian dialects preserved out in the Pacific and in Madagascar, so they might have been the original people who were supposed to have been lost. The nature of the psychology is the next topic we should take up. In the modern schools of psychology, we know the subconscious vaguely. The kahunas knew it ever so much better. They knew what it could do, knew its abilities, and just how to put the subconscious to work. The knowledge of the conscious mind has not been improved on very much in all these years, except to say that it is the one that lives in the body with the subconscious and is the boss. It uses its will to make the subconscious obey and to do the various things that it wishes to have it do. But the subconscious has all of the memories and the instincts and the care of the body, the digestion and all of those things in its keeping. The superconscious does not live in the body. It is the father within, the father-mother within, we should say, only in this way. It has a silvery cord that connects it. No matter where it is, it has work to do on the higher planes above. But through that silvery cord, which is mentioned in the Bible, it is in constant contact. It's like being on the end of a telephone line, and always there when you ring the bell, it can hear, and if it isn't too busy with something very important, It will come closer, make the contact, and then we can make our prayers, our appeals, and offer our sacrificial gifts. One of the elements in the psychology, which modern psychology has not caught up with at all, is the vital force as a thing which can be transferred between oneself and another. In Huna, the low self makes the vital force from the food and the air and the water which we consume as we go along. The middle self, which lives in the animal body, which belongs really to the low self, as a guest, takes what it needs of this vital force from the body as it is provided, and changes it a little bit. The word for that vital force is mana. You run into it with two N's in the Old Testament, and the mystery of the mana in the Old Testament becomes no mystery at all when you know that that was the mana of the vital force which the kahunas knew and used. The middle self takes some of this vital force and changes its voltage, you might say, or its rate of vibration in some way. When it uses it, it becomes hypnotic force. If it is used properly, it can be used to give suggestion, self-suggestion, to the low self of the person, or it can be used by a hypnotic operator to give suggestion to someone, some other person's low self. That is the mechanism of hypnosis. The suggestion is passed back and forth, either by word of mouth, by the ear, or it can be done silently through thought forms. The thought forms are known to theosophy, but not to modern psychology. It has no conception of a thought form, how a thought form is made, or how it is sent along the acric cord. The high self does not have a body, and it does not have the easy access to the vital force that the middle self has, because the middle self is right in the body. The high self makes contact with us at night when we sleep and draws what the vital force it needs to keep alive and to keep at work and to be strong on its own level, where it doesn't take a great deal of the vital force. But in order to answer our prayers and to make changes in our circumstances, to guide us, to heal us, and to do all of the things that we wish it to do and ask it to do in our Huna-type prayers, it needs a large supply of vital force. And one of the basic things that we learn in Huna is how to accumulate an extra amount of the vital force, the mana, and then how to send it to the high self. You have to make a contact with your high self along the silvery cord, call it closer, and then you present as a gift of your own vital force. You give yourself, you might say, to the high self to strengthen it. First, it is given as a gift of love. Then it is given as a gift with the prayer. That is a gift with a little tag tied to it. I am giving you this gift of vital force so that you may do so-and-so for me. That is perfectly legitimate in the whole of Huna and is one of the most valuable things. The discovery of the superconscious, the high self, the Almakua, is the greatest single forward step in the religious life, any person's life. Religious life might be a poor word for it, spiritual growth. But it is the greatest step. In years past, people had no idea of the Father within, just what it was, or how to work with it, or to use it. The Hindus had a lot of assorted ideas, but they didn't get them straight. They got them all mixed up with other things, so that the high self was mixed up with the ultimate God. above the high self in Huna, there lie still higher beings who are quite beyond the range of human conception. But they have evolved farther. They evolve from the high self to what they call the high self, or the God high self. And above that, until finally they postulate away beyond the conception of man, the power of mind to probe, the ultimate God. We have three selves in Huna, in the psychology. We have the three vital forces, the three grades of mana, and we have the three shadowy bodies. They call them akka, or shadows in the Polynesian, and those were the bodies that the spirits, the subconscious, conscious, and superconscious, are spirits in their concept. The spirits lived in those bodies when they passed out of the physical and into the next level, the other side, we call it. During life, the shadowy bodies are so arranged that they surround and interpenetrate the physical body, except for the shadowy body of the high self, which makes its own halo. The shadowy bodies are so arranged that a portion of them make the silvery cord, the cord that connects the low self with the superconscious. A strange thing that we will talk about a great deal in our class work, if we organize classes, will be the fact that the subconscious has the telephone line along the akka cord, or the silvery cord, to the high self, and not the middle self. So, if we wish to pray, to get in contact with the high self, to give it our requests, we have to go through the subconscious. And that is a very large part of the mechanism of magic, to learn to work through your own subconscious to get to the superconscious. The subconscious is able to handle telepathy. The conscious mind is unable to handle telepathy. And as all prayer is telepathically sent by the low self along the silver cord to the high self, you can see how important it is to establish a working relationship with the low self when you begin to send prayers. All prayers go telepathically to the high self, whether we intend to have them sent that way by the low self or not. Any prayer uttered emotionally will be sent more or less telepathically to the high self, because there's no place else for it to go. No matter where you address a prayer to, what God or to what virgin or what saint, it always can go only to the high self. That is the only place where a prayer sent telepathically, and all prayers telepathic, can be sent. The tenth element in the Huna, in addition to the three selves, the three vital forces, the three spirit or shadowy bodies, is the physical body. And we have that only during life. In modern psychology, we have just a part of these ten elements. The reason that most prayers are unanswered is that we do not understand the mechanism of getting the subconscious to send the prayers telepathically to the high self. The prayers are so often empty words. They might just as well be saved as to get up and in churches, for instance. The great many prayers that are offered are more or less of a ritual. The individual prayer, when it is the prayer of the working white magic of Huna, is addressed through the low self to the high self. The vital force is offered as a gift to the high self.
the thought forms are carefully made, or a picture is made complete with the thought forms, like a jigsaw puzzle, of the thing desired, not the things that have been feared. The desired things are made into a picture, and that picture is sent as the seed to the high self, and the high self then uses the vital force, the mana, which we offer and give as gifts of love, to make the seed grow. If we hurt anyone or wish to hurt anyone with a prayer, for instance, if we pray for someone to be forced to do something, the high selves will not answer that prayer. We cannot encroach upon the free will of the other person. Our time is running out, and I think that you have heard enough about Huna to give you an idea of its basic nature and of the benefits which may accrue to a person who wishes to make a study of the methods, of the way of applying them, of the way of making the Huna prayer, and also the benefit of living the hurtless life. This ends the lecture for tonight, and I wish you aloha.